Today is Tuesday, April 17th. We're going to talk about fluid electrolyte balance today. Okay, so a lot of this stuff here at the beginning of fluid electrolyte balance is actually kind of a rerun for us. Back in Bio 210, you may recall having learned about the fluid compartments in the body, and the number one most common place for fluid to be housed is where?
Intracellular,
good. So intracellular fluid accounts for around 25 or so liters of fluid in your body. That's around two-thirds of your bodily fluids. You know, that's a huge amount of fluid that we have stored inside our cells. And the catch is the plasma membrane provides protection to that fluid. To access that fluid, you have to deal with going through that plasma membrane. So number one storage location is intracellular fluid. That's about two-thirds of our bodily fluids. Means pretty much everything else in your body is considered extracellular fluid. By saying extracellular, where are we talking about?
Outside
the cell. Good. So ECF is extracellular fluid. And that's about one-third of our bodily fluids. That, again, is about 15 liters of fluid. So we're looking at about a total of 40 or so liters of fluid that we transport in our bodies. And it's all about perspective. If you're talking about fluids in the cell, that's a great majority of the fluids that we transport. You know, if we're talking about, say, extracellular fluid, that's actually a much smaller portion of fluid that we're discussing. To put this in perspective, let's talk about blood plasma for a minute. Would you classify blood plasma as intracellular or extracellular? It's extracellular, good. So I'll put it down here. And we know from earlier in this course, how much total blood do we transport?
5 liters.
And about 55% of that is plasma, so we're looking at around 2.5 liters of fluid in our blood plasma. Well, when you say, hey, we've got 25 liters inside of our cells, that's only 10% of our fluid that's actually housed inside, you know, the bloodstream. So not a great deal of fluid when you look at it that way. Another major fluid area in the extracellular space is interstitial fluid, or IF for short. Where is that fluid housed? Cells and tissues, right? Not inside, but rather outside. And they've recently come out and said that they believe the interstitial fluid and the tissue spaces that fluid resides in actually constitutes an organ. So they think it's that complex, it contributes that much to our bodies. The interstitial fluids and the interstitial space is an organ. So that kind of moves it up the ranks there a little bit. So when we're talking about fluid electrolyte balance, we're going to think about 40 liters or so in total that we have in our bodies, with the majority of those fluids housed where?
ICF,
good. So the majority of those fluids housed in our intracellular space. Thinking about water balance depends on your age, your gender, how much body fat you have, and how much muscle tissue you have. You know, we often joke about as we get older, we wrinkle up and we prune up. You know, we joke about old people becoming like little dried up prunes. It is no joke. We actually do dry up as we age. Babies are born with about 80% of their bodies composed of water. And by the time you're in your 80s, only 50% of your body is composed of water. For most of your adult life, around 60-something, about 65% of your body is composed of water. So, you know, we do tend to dry up as we get older. That means that older people who are only 50% water are going to have a harder time maintaining hydration. Why is that? If you're only 50% water and you're dehydrated, it doesn't move you far, does it? I mean, you're already in that low water zone in the first place. Babies also have trouble with maintaining hydration, and that's because their bodies are tiny. So even though they're 80% water, it doesn't take much for them to become dehydrated either. So those two ends of the age spectrum are the ones we have to be cautious about in terms of maintaining hydration. On your worksheet there, got a blank to fill in. Water content decreases with age. Water content decreases with age. Number two, males have more water than females. Males have more water than females. Why is that? Bigger body mass and more muscle tissue. Yeah. So fat has no water in it at all. Fat is completely water-free. So the more fat you've got, the less water content you actually can hold. So for number three, the percentage of water will decrease. Percentage of water will decrease with an increase in body fat. So fat contains no water, but muscle does contain water. Muscle is kind of, you know, filled with water in the tissue spaces. So number four there, you'll notice that water content increases with increased muscle tissue. So those who have more fat in their body tissues are going to float when we get in the water like a swimming pool. Those with more muscle tissue will sink. Yeah, so just the way it works. How about questions on that page? We lose and gain around 2.5 liters of fluid per day. If you have a highlighter handy, I would highlight that number, very top of page 119. Okay, so if you have a highlighter handy, I would highlight that number. We lose and gain around 2.5 liters of fluid per day. Most of the fluids that we get is what we call performed water, and that's water that you take in through the foods that you eat and mostly through drinks. There's actually a small amount of water that comes from metabolism, but that's not enough to keep us alive. You'll notice on your sheet it's around, you know, 250 milliliters per day. That's not enough fluid to live off of, so you really have to rely on the foods that you eat and the drink that you take in to get that water per day. So, you know, you're probably thinking, boy, I don't drink 2.5 liters of fluid. That'd be a lot of liquid per day. We get only a certain amount from what we drink. The rest of it, you know, food is not dry as a chip. You know, most foods have some moisture in them, and that's where we do get the additional amount of water. So what comes in should roughly equal what goes out. If you're taking in 2.5 liters per day, you're going to probably lose about 2.5 liters per day. To minimize the fluid loss, we have the thirst mechanism, and that thirst mechanism helps to limit how much fluid you lose. So how do you know you're thirsty?
You have dry mouth.
Dry mouth? Do you have any other symptoms? Throat's getting dry?
Just thirsty.
You think you're thirsty, yeah.
Cough.
What's that?
Coughing.
Maybe cough, yeah.
Low blood pressure.
Low blood pressure, that's another one. Yeah. Anybody ever notice how your saliva becomes kind of thick?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you have all these symptoms, you dry mouth, dry throat, low blood pressure, you know, rubbery, thick, mucus-like saliva in your mouth, these are all things that say, I probably want to have something to drink. So this is part of the thirst mechanism. There are symptoms there that are turned on when your blood is too salty. And that helps us to retain more fluids by drinking and also by the activities of the kidneys. So this term here, increased osmotic pressure, does that deal with too much fluid or too much salt in your bloodstream?
Too much salt.
Too much salt, right. So just like if you have a salty meal and you don't drink with it, you're going to have the urge to drink to dilute down that saltiness in your bloodstream. So behind the scenes, you know, you're drinking, but behind the scenes, ADH is released from your posterior pituitary. It travels to your kidney, And in what particular portion does it insert aquaporin water channels? PCT, loop of Henle, or DCT?
DCT.
Good. And once those water channels are inserted, your kidney now reclaims more water. Right. Okay, so the more water you put back in your bloodstream, the more you can dilute down the salt.
Didn't you say water was absorbed on the descending loop of Henle?
It is if you're adjusting the saltiness of the filtrate.
Uh-huh.
But if you're doing facultative absorption of water, that's over in the DCT.
Okay.
I want you to notice aldosterone is not part of this whole mechanism. Why would we not want aldosterone to help us out when we're thirsty?
Sodium salt,
yeah. So if you're already too salty, you don't want aldosterone to make you saltier. Yeah, so you just want the water to be retained there. I know it seems like a silly question, but on your worksheet, I do have it for you. When do you stop drinking? When the thirst is quenched and you're not thirsty anymore. Okay, so when you're no longer thirsty or your thirst has been quenched, we no longer drink. There are times when people ignore the thirst mechanism and they drink anyway. Alcohol is one of those cases, right?
Mm-hmm.
So people say, they don't listen to that thirst mechanism that says, hey, you're already full of fluid, don't drink anymore. But the more you drink, the more you can flush out your sodium, your electrolytes. So there's a reason that we have to stop drinking when our body says to do so. Because once you get your osmotic pressure back to normal, what would adding more fluid to your bloodstream do to that osmotic pressure?
Decrease it.
Yeah, make you less salty. So if you're less salty, then your fluids escape your capillaries, and now you have edema and swelling. So we don't want to flip to the other end of the spectrum here. Okay, so thirst mechanism is a way to maintain fluid loss. We're going to lose around 2.5 liters of fluid per day anyway. This mechanism helps us make sure that we don't lose too much of that fluid. All right, so if you've got your highlighter handy, the number one route for fluid loss is through your urinary system and through the kidneys. You'll notice a value there, 1.5 liters or 1,500 milliliters. That's the typical amount of fluid that we lose through the kidneys every day. That's a value to highlight as well.
You left the metal on the cell. It says Peter Higgins.
Did you get that? Okay.
Ms. Taylor, what did you want us to highlight?
Kidneys are the number one route for fluid loss. And then secondly, highlight the value, 1,500 milliliters or 1.5 liters. That's the volume of fluid that we should pee per day. So by the word skin, you'll notice the word insensible fluid loss. What does that mean?
Like sweat.
Sweat. And is this sweat that you're consciously aware of?
No.
So it's sweat that you don't realize is leaving your body. So every day, especially dry days, we're going to sweat. We're going to lose an undetermined amount of fluid that's, to us, we're not really sure how much fluid we're losing. Now, if you have wet armpits, you certainly know you're sweating. That's sensible fluid loss, but insensible fluid loss means you're not aware of how much you're losing. Okay, so the lungs and the skin actually both participate in insensible fluid loss. You actually breathe off in your lungs a lot of fluid per day that's exhaled in your breath. And it may come as a surprise that the GI tract is actually the least route for fluid loss. You'll notice in our feces, we only lose about 100 milliliters of fluid per day. So that really kind of drives home the point that, you know, fluid loss is coming from the urinary system, not from the digestive system. To add to this conversation about fluid loss, let's talk about hormones. What impact do ADH and aldosterone have on fluid loss? They decrease it. And if they decrease fluid loss, they also decrease urine output, and that's our blank. So both ADH and aldosterone will decrease urine output. On the other end of the spectrum, hyperventilation, vomiting and diarrhea, and fever and burns can all increase fluid loss. So hyperventilation number 3, 4, and 5, they all three increase fluid loss.
One and two would decrease?
One and two are decrease. Okay, so take home message from this page, the total exchangeable fluids per day is around how many liters?
2.5.
How much fluid do you typically lose through urine per day? 1.5 liters, good. And the number one route for fluid loss?
Kidneys,
good. And the thirst mechanism operates with which hormone?
ADH,
good. And the trigger or stimulus for the thirst mechanism is increased what pressure?
Osmotic
pressure, meaning you're too salty or not salty enough?
Too salty.
Too salty, good. Okay.
There are some people that are too salty.
Maybe they need some ADH. Okay, any questions on 119? If you've got like 105 degree fever, you're sweating, yeah. And the burns, if you've got like inflammation, then that radiates heat loss. Or if you've got skin missing, then now you've got evaporative, you know, off the skin.
Okay.
So it depends on the severity, but there's a great deal of fluid that can be lost without the skin. Yeah. On the next page, you've got a chart. Let me help you with this because there's a lot of information here. The first two columns, the one titled electrolyte and the next one titled controlled by, I would put a star above those columns and know those first two columns. Okay, so there's a chart here, electrolyte column and controlled by column. I would put a star above those two columns and know what's in those two. The next column is titled function. I think most of that is just FYI. I don't think, you know, that there's anything terribly new there. You've probably learned this at some point throughout 210 or 211. So the function column is an FYI column. In the last two columns, you'll notice some bold-faced terms. For instance, if I said hypernatremia, you would say, oh, that means what?
Too much sodium,
yes, too much sodium or too much salt. If I said hyponatremia, you would say that means
too little sodium
or salt. That's what you want to know about those terms in the right-hand column. You're not responsible for the causes or the symptoms, but just know that hypernatremia means extra salt, you know, hypercalcemia, hypocalcemia, and so forth. At the very bottom, you'll notice a little bit about acidosis and alkalosis. This is just double dipping what we've done in lab. So I'm thinking that there's nothing new in those last two bits down there about respiratory and metabolic acidosis and alkalosis.
So are you saying we need to know that?
Let's see what it's got in there.
Acidosis, alkalosis, or just the term?
You know, I think it will help you with urinary, so yeah, I would make sure to look at those,
okay,
those bottom two boxes in case of respiratory acidosis and, yeah, all those four. So when we're talking about this chapter, we're not talking about fluids by themselves or electrolytes by themselves. We're actually talking about the balance between the fluids and the electrolytes. And so what I want to just kind of recap with on that page,
You'll notice that sodium is actually the most common cation in the extracellular fluids. So looking at this picture, sodium is found not necessarily inside your cells, but rather sitting outside your cells and in the blood plasma. Those are all extracellular spaces. If you think back to, say, Bio-210, that makes good sense, because at resting state, where is sodium in relation to muscles and nerves?
Outside.
Yes, so that makes sense that we expect sodium to be outside our cells. You'll notice calcium is listed as the most common ion in the body, but there's kind of a trick here. It's not necessarily in your fluids as much as it is stored where? In your bones, right. So there is blood calcium, and there's calcium in your interstitial fluids, but the majority of our calcium is tied up in storage. So there's kind of a weirdness about the calcium. So catch the terminology here. Sodium is the most common cation in your extracellular fluids. But if we're talking your entire body, it is calcium. Okay, but keeping in mind, the calcium is primarily stored in your bones. Okay, so let me repeat that. Sodium is the most common cation in your extracellular fluids. But if we're talking most common ion in your entire body, it happens to be calcium. But calcium is actually stored mostly in your bones. In the body. So you're going to want to look on the test for those keywords. Sodium is common in the extracellular fluids. Mm-hmm. Calcium, the key word is in the body. Okay, so, but nonetheless, calcium is mostly stored in your bones. You're right, they're both in the same places.
Oh, okay.
But the majority of your calcium
is,
yeah.
Okay.
Potassium, you'll notice, is mostly an intracellular cation. It's stored inside our cells. And thinking back to bones, or rather muscles and nerves, you learned that already, that during resting potential, potassium is inside a muscle or a nerve. So this is not anything that's necessarily new. Chlorine likes to hang with sodium, so they together are in the extracellular fluids. Chlorine for us is really important for maintaining acid production for the stomach, so that's a good reason to have enough chlorine. And then finally, bicarbonate. We've actually talked a lot about bicarbonate. We've talked about it in reference to carbon dioxide. We've also talked about it as a way to maintain blood pH. So it is a major buffer system in the body, one that helps us maintain blood pH. And it can actually do so very quickly over the short term of a few minutes. And it can also be regulated by, you know, respiratory system and by urinary system. So it's certainly an important one for our bodies in terms of a buffer. Okay, so just appreciating that we have fluids and electrolytes to talk about today, not just fluid movements. Let's now turn our attention to page 121.
Yeah. Bicarbonate
is extracellular. Okay, so what I'd like to do is take you through bulk fluid transport. We've been here before in chapter 19, but then take it a step further in talking about how we do this fluid electrolyte balance issue. So why don't we do this? Why don't we look at page 121? Okay, So there were two major pressures when we talked about capillaries and filtration and reabsorption back in chapter 19. Can you tell me one of those pressures?
Hydrostatic.
Good. Hydrostatic pressure. And it's the same as blood pressure. Is it a force that pushes or pulls fluids?
Pushes.
Okay, so we'll just make note of that one first. Blood pressure, same as blood hydrostatic pressure. Blood pressure and blood hydrostatic pressure, same thing. This is a pushy fluid. You know, it's the force of that fluid pushing against the walls of our capillary. So back in chapter 19, I mentioned you did not have to learn the individual pressure numbers. Same thing goes here as well. Let's talk about them there. At the arterial end of the capillary, the blood hydrostatic pressure is around 35 millimeters mercury. Okay, so what do you expect to happen to blood pressure or hydrostatic pressure as you travel to the venule end?
Decreases.
Good. Gets lower because we're pushing out those fluids. All right, so we see blood pressure or hydrostatic pressure drop to the mid-teens by the time you reach the venule end of your capillary. So we did talk about a very small bit of hydrostatic pressure in your interstitial space. It is not a great amount of pressure. It is less than 1 millimeter mercury. So we're going to exclude it from our conversation again. It's not really important for understanding this push-pull that's going on inside the capillary. Now, the other pressure is called blood osmotic pressure. And what creates that pressure? Good. And is it a pulling pressure or a pushing pressure?
Pulling.
Pulls. Good. So blood osmotic pressure is a force that pulls fluids, and a force is created by the presence of salts and proteins in your blood plasma. The blood osmotic pressure at the arterial end is around 26 millimeters mercury. Do you recall, excuse me, what happens to it over the length of your capillary? So BOP is 26 at the arterial end. What happens to this pressure as you travel along the length?
It stays the same.
Yeah. So yeah, nothing happens to it, right? Trick question. There is some osmotic pressure in your interstitial space. Again, it's a small amount. It has a small contribution to this push-pull mechanism, but we're going to ignore it again, so it doesn't play a big role here. Going back to chapter 19, we did calculate a net filtration pressure, and at the arterial end, it was about what?
10.
Good. So just to repeat where that number comes from,
If you take 35, which is your push number, and you subtract away 26, which is your pull number, you're going to get 9. And then we account for the small amount of osmotic and hydrostatic pressure in your interstitial space, and that gives you about a 10 overall ability to push, 10 millimeters mercury. Down here at the venule end, what happens to that net filtration pressure?
It's less.
It's less, yes. So we're in fact looking at a negative number. This time we're only pushing with 15 to 18 millimeters mercury. We're in fact pulling with 26, so that becomes a negative number. So overall, our net filtration pressure happens to be a negative 8 millimeters mercury. And again, that's really the only number that we're gonna need to focus on here. So this was the story from chapter 19. This is basically how we talked about it back then. The overall mechanism at the arterial end of the capillary is to push out fluids. Which pressure is responsible for pushing fluids at the arterial end?
Hydrostatic.
Good. And the name of the process that moves those fluids out is?
Filtration.
Filtration. Good. Okay, and by the time you reach the venule end of your capillary, which pressure is responsible for reabsorbing?
Osmotic.
Osmotic, good. Osmotic pressure stays the same because your total amount of salts and proteins or solutes really don't change.
Okay.
So your albumin and those kinds of plasma proteins really, they're trying to stay in the bloodstream. Some may escape,
mm-hmm.
but they're more or less stable.
They're more inside. Okay.
Yeah, they're more inside. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Got other questions so far? Okay, so this is normal. This is what we expect to see when the conditions are normal, meaning blood pressure is normal, salt and protein levels are normal. We also know that about 90% of our fluids do get reabsorbed at the venule end of our capillary, meaning 10% of those fluids in the interstitial space are picked up by what?
Lymphatic system.
Yeah. So there's also that secondary player in this whole mechanism in maintaining, getting those fluids and proteins back into the bloodstream. Okay, so where are you stuck? Any part of this I need to go back over for you? On a scale of 1 to 10, if 10's most comfortable, where are you?
8.
Okay. This better than last time?
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said whatever gets left out gets picked up by the lymphatic system.
That's right. That's right. Ready to move on?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you flip on over with me to 122. So the name of today's topic is fluid electrolyte balance. Fluid is hydrostatic pressure, electrolyte is osmotic pressure. And if you have some change in fluids, you change hydrostatic pressure. If you have something that changes your electrolytes, salts, solutes, or proteins, now what pressure do you change?
Osmotic,
right. So we're just going to kind of keep that in perspective as to maintain this push-pull mechanism and to maintain net filtration pressure at each end at 10 and negative 8. We've got to have the right amount of fluid balanced with the right amount of salt, solutes, and proteins. So there's two issues here. We can have dehydration. Dehydration technically means we're losing something. And if dehydration is losing something, what must overhydration be?
Too much, yeah.
So I'm going to turn what you know about dehydration on its head today. Okay, so if somebody's had, say, a really bad case of vomiting and diarrhea for days, we're really concerned about their electrolyte balance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we're really concerned about the amount of fluids that they've been lost, and we try to force ice to this person and give them, you know, anything that they can hold down and drink. But it's really those electrolytes that we talk about losing when we have vomiting and diarrhea. So people can lose fluids, people can lose electrolytes, they can lose both. So when we talk about dehydration, we don't just mean losing fluids. We could specifically mean protein loss, solute loss, salt loss, electrolyte loss. So dehydration comes in different forms. In fact, in three different forms here, isotonic, hypotonic, and hypertonic dehydration. We'll come to overhydration in just a few minutes. Before we go into the details here, you actually know how this works. You already know the mechanism. Back in Bio-210, when you learned about osmosis, what happens to cells that are placed in hypotonic solutions?
They swell.
And if you put that cell in a hypertonic solution, that cell will
shrink.
So thinking about those solutions, is a hypertonic solution really, really salty, or is it not very salty?
It's really, really salty.
And a hypotonic solution?
Not very salty.
And an isotonic solution?
Balanced out.
Good, same, balanced out. Okay, so you already know how this is gonna resolve. If you have hypotonic dehydration, you're gonna swell. If you have hypertonic dehydration, you're gonna shrink and shrivel. And if you have isotonic dehydration, you're gonna stay the same. Okay. So don't forget that, because that's like the core of this, right? Okay. So I'm gonna give you the meat to how you get there. Okay, let's start with the easy one. This one's called isotonic dehydration. Iso, you told me, is same or equal. And this is a situation where you lose equal amounts of salts, solutes, proteins, or fluids. You know, salts and fluids, you lose in equal amounts. I should tell you that I use the word salt, solute, electrolyte, and protein right now interchangeably. So right now we're talking about all those doing the same thing. They're all creating what pressure?
Osmotic,
right. So right now in this conversation, I'm using salt, solute, protein, and electrolyte all interchangeably. They all have the same impact. So if I'm losing equal amounts of fluids and electrolytes or salts, then I'm not going to really change my numbers here. If I lower my net filtration pressure on the arterial end to 8, and I lower my net filtration pressure on the venule end to -6, am I still filtering and reabsorbing?
Yes.
Still doing the same thing. So I really didn't change the ability to filter fluids out and reabsorb them back in. So there's no net fluid change for our cells. The cells will not bloat, nor will they shrivel. Okay, so no overall net fluid change. Okay, so no overall change in filtration or reabsorption. So no overall net change in filtration or reabsorption. Notice the list of examples here on your paper. There's things like one-off instances of diarrhea, a one-off diarrhea, a one-off instance of vomiting, a single incidence of a bleed, like from a hemorrhage. Okay, fasting, maybe just one morning you're busy, you don't eat or drink. Okay, so these are just one-off instances, meaning there's an equal loss of water and salt from the bloodstream. Now, that's the clue words you want to look for. When we talk about these isotonic dehydration events, look for the equal loss of salts and proteins and water. That's going to be the clue word that we're dealing with. No overall net change in the way our fluids are moved. It'll bounce out, yeah. As soon as you eat and drink or whatnot, then you're back to normal. Yeah. All right, any questions on isotonic dehydration? So keep in mind what we're doing here is we're looking at dehydration from a perspective of what we're losing. So the next one called hypotonic dehydration, this time we're looking at it from a perspective of losing salts, solutes, proteins, or electrolytes. Okay, so hypotonic dehydration, again, we're looking at it from a perspective of what we're losing. And in this condition, we're losing salts, solutes, proteins, or electrolytes. Which pressure depends on electrolytes?
Osmotic.
Okay, so that's going to be my next point. If your loss is strictly protein, salt, solutes, electrolytes, you're going to decrease your BOP. So let's play with our numbers down here. Let's take this 26 and let's knock it down to 10. Let's take this 26 and knock it down. Okay, so at your arterial end, is your hydrostatic pressure still the one able to force out fluids?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so filtration is still good. Okay, at the venule end, the osmotic pressure should be your higher value, but this time it's actually not. Your hydrostatic pressure is your higher value. So what's happening at your venule end? Still pushing out, still filtering. Why can you not reabsorb? Osmotic pressure? Too low. Yeah, so there's not enough salt here or proteins or electrolytes to pull the fluids back in at the venule end. So that means that instead of reabsorbing, we're continuing to filter across the entire length of the capillary. So when you push fluids out into the interstitial space, they can accumulate there, causing swelling known as edema. And that space can get kind of full. We can even force fluids into your cells, and then they will
swell
and bloat. Yep. So that's what we already knew. We knew that osmotic conditions that are hypotonic in nature will make cells bloat, and it's because you can't reabsorb fluids back at the venule end of your capillary. Okay, so if you decrease osmotic pressure, you're going to cause a shift in the fluid movement. All right, and so they move from your blood plasma to your interstitial fluids and then to your intracellular space. Okay, so you move fluids from blood plasma to interstitial fluid into the intracellular space. And And we say that when we have extra fluids in the interstitial space, the condition's called edema. And if the extra fluid moves into your cells, we now say your cells bloat or swell. I'm going to use the word bloat because it has an O. So does BOP. So does hypotonic. So I'm using that to help keep me straight. So let me throw a couple of examples out. Let's say we have somebody who has low levels of a hormone called aldosterone. What does aldosterone make your kidneys retain?
Salt.
Okay, so without aldosterone, which pressure will be decreased? Osmotic pressure will be decreased. And without osmotic pressure, you're no longer able to reabsorb fluids, you're just filtering across the entire length of the capillary. So into which space do you push fluids first? Interstitial. And when that space becomes swollen with fluids, you now have intracellular, or yeah, moving inside the cells. So edema specifically means you've got fluids in the interstitial space. Bloated cells result when that fluid moves into your cells. Okay, so what is the name of that disease where you don't have enough aldosterone? It was on the same page as Cushing's, but it's called Addison's. Addison's. So Addison's can do this to us. Let's talk about another issue. Let's say that we have someone with hepatitis, inflammation of the liver, and if the liver is inflamed, it may no longer make enough proteins like albumin. All right, so which pressure do we affect?
Osmotic,
right. So the lack of protein, the loss of protein, means that osmotic pressure is decreased. Anytime you decrease osmotic pressure, what happens to your cells in the interstitial space? They bloat, they swell, right. Okay, so the clues to look for, the questions will say loss of electrolyte, loss of salt, loss of solutes, loss of proteins, and you'll know that that is a clue that says we're losing which pressure?
Osmotic.
And then as a result, how do the fluids move differently?
They continue to filter.
Good. Continue to filter, cannot reabsorb. Okay. So extensive problems, you know, like long-term issues, tend to result in this kind of condition. So if you have diarrhea that's one-off that now becomes a, you know, several day event, that can shift us into hypotonic dehydration. So let's take a look at the perspective here. If you're losing fluids through diarrhea, it's not as bad as losing electrolytes through diarrhea, okay? So it's the primary thing that you're losing that becomes the driver of what happens, okay? So if when you have diarrhea, yeah, there's fluids that leave you, but the biggest issue is it's those electrolytes that we're not able to absorb. Okay, so let's now turn our attention to hypertonic dehydration. So blood plasma has two major components. It has water and it has electrolytes and proteins. If the loss is primarily the fluid and not the electrolytes and proteins, we're going to classify that as a hypertonic dehydration event. Okay, so hypertonic dehydration, what we see here is the issue is losing fluids from the bloodstream. Which pressure depends on fluids?
Hydrostatic.
Yeah, hydrostatic. Let's play with our numbers again. Okay,
So if we change down our hydrostatic pressure to something like 10, our osmotic pressure here, we're going to leave it at a stable 26. At the arterial end of your capillary, what's happening? You can't push the fluid. Yeah, your hydrostatic is too low. The only thing you can do is reabsorb. That's right. Come down to the venule end. Anything changed?
Same.
Still reabsorbing, right? So here's the catch. It is easiest to pull the fluids from the interstitial space first because they're not contained within the plasma membrane. So we start pulling from interstitial fluid into the capillary. When that space between the cells and tissues becomes concentrated, where do you tap into next for fluids? In the cells. So eventually the cells will start draining fluid and it just trails back into the capillary. Okay, so the way I'm going to write this is just for simplicity. We're going to say that fluids move from the intracellular space to the interstitial space, ultimately back into the plasma. Okay, so fluids move from intracellular space, ICF, to intra or interstitial fluid back into the blood capillary. So we're just moving fluid into the capillaries to the bloodstream. Ultimately, what happens to all this excess fluid that we're moving out? Goes to the kidneys.
And out.
And out.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So the kidneys say, hey, look at all this extra fluid. We don't need this fluid. Let it go. So it just goes out in the urine. Let's talk through some examples here. We've got two forms of diabetes, diabetes insipidus and diabetes mellitus. Both forms have a similar symptom, polyuria. What does that mean?
Excessive urination.
Good. And of course, that's followed by polydipsia, which is excessive. Okay, so what specifically is a diabetic, either form, losing in the urine?
Water.
Good. No talk about salt here, right? It's just the water that we're losing. So the salt's not really the issue with this type of, either type of diabetes. Diabetes mellitus has a complicating issue. What is pulling that water into the urine?
Sugar.
Yeah, sugar's pulling it in. So the bigger issue here is the primary loss. The thing that you're losing the most of is what we do to classify this. Because with diabetes, the primary loss is fluid, we're going to classify it as a hypertonic dehydration. Okay? So if the primary loss had been, say, glucose or salt, we would classify it as hypo. Yeah. So because it's loss of fluid that we're dealing with, massive amounts of fluid, we say it's a hypertonic dehydration event. Okay, so when we lose fluids, we're losing the pushing power of hydrostatic pressure. And since we're no longer able to filter, we're simply reabsorbing. We pull fluids from the interstitial space. We then pull fluids from the cell. Those fluids all end up back in your capillary. Of course, that fluid travels to your kidneys, and all this excess fluid is flushed out of your kidneys and the urine. Okay, so that really kind of explains what's happening with diabetes. We're just flushing out those fluids, pulling them out of our interstitial space. Okay, so let's look at another example from page 123. Let's talk about sweating. Now, so I know you're thinking, okay, sweat. Sweat has water in it. It has salt. It has some waste products like urea. So of those things there, the biggest issue is fluid loss. Okay, so yeah, there's salt being lost, but the bigger issue is how much fluid you lose in relation. And since we say fluids are lost, which pressure is primarily lost?
Hydrostatic.
And then the fluids move from the cells and tissue spaces into the capillary. Right.
And ultimately, you pee out and get rid of that extra fluid that should have been hanging out in your interstitial space. Okay, so we look at the clues there. This can be considered, you know, dehydration can be considered loss. Let's talk about overhydration for just a moment. That's looking at it from a perspective of what you're getting too much of. All right, and that one's on the bottom of page 123. There's actually three different forms of overhydration, but the one we're going to focus on is hypotonic overhydration. So with this form of overhydration, a person may be getting too much water to balance out the sodium salt electrolytes that they have. So let me give you an example of how this may work. If someone goes out into the yard on a hot summer afternoon and does a lot of yard work and does not constantly rehydrate, this person may come in the house hours later and say, "Man, I'm thirsty, give me something to drink." Anything you have at home, with the exception of things like Gatorade and Pedialyte, are hypotonic fluids. That includes soft drinks, tea, milk, tap water, of course. Even alcohol is hypotonic to our cells. So any of those fluids that you pick to rehydrate with are going to be lacking those electrolytes that have been lost. So getting too much water into our bodies is the issue here, not enough electrolytes coming in with those fluids. So this condition ends up resulting in an increase in which pressure?
Hydrostatic.
Good. How did you know that? It's water, yeah. If you increase hydrostatic pressure, let's play with our numbers again. If you have a really high hydrostatic pressure, you're filtering at the arterial end. And if it stays high at the venule end, you're still filtering. So you end up pushing fluids into what space first? The interstitial, and then into the
ICF,
that's right. Does this look familiar? It looks exactly like which problem? Dehydration. Yeah. So these two, hypotonic dehydration and hypotonic hydration or overhydration, end up with the same results. A few years ago, you probably heard this story, there was a contest in California called Hold Your Wii for Nintendo Wii. They brought contestants out, they had them drink gallons of water, and they said, okay, whoever pees last, you know, the Hold Your Wii portion, is the one to win the Nintendo console. A nurse called into this radio station who was holding the contest and said, you know, you really shouldn't be doing this. You know, she tried to talk to them about this kind of issue here and explained that, you know, somebody could end up being really hurt or dying from this issue. There was a 28-year-old mother of three who participated, went home with a really awful headache, did not win the consoles, called her mom and said, I've got a horrible splitting headache, I'm gonna lay down on the sofa. Unfortunately, she died from cerebral edema because of hypotonic overhydration. So she was drinking too much water. It's a short period of time. Keep in mind, how fast can your kidneys filter fluid? GFR is about 120 milliliters per minute. Yeah, so your kidneys say, hey, you drank all that water, but I have one speed and I work at this one speed. And that's all we'll do. Yeah, so unfortunately, this can happen very quickly in terms of the fluid shift. The edema can occur in the brain. Your brain can push up against your skull. It can force your brainstem down into the foramen magnum, and that can shut off vital body function. So really unfortunate, that situation. You can do this going in the yard and working and getting really hot and sweaty and then coming in and drinking, and cause the same effects of hypotonic overhydration. Lauren?
How much water would it take to actually cause that to happen?
I'm thinking probably a few liters or more, taken in a really short period of time. They say that if you're coming in, you're dehydrated, to do a cup or two every, say, 20, 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. But if you're dying thirsty, you're not gonna limit yourself. But they say to limit it to a cup or two of fluid every so often. Give your kidneys a time to filter. Yeah. So let me take you over to page 124. Instead of memorizing lists of problems associated with each type of dehydration or overhydration, look for the clue words. Dehydration should say we're losing something. Overhydration probably says we've got too much. Okay, so number one is done for you on page 124. Let's hit number two. A person drinking a large amount of seawater. Ooh, that's a bad thing. It causes hypernatremia. What is that?
Too much salt.
Too much salt. And it also causes too little fluids. Okay, so what I did was I added up here, too much salt and too little fluids have the same result. How would you classify this form of dehydration?
Hypertonic.
Hypertonic, yes, hypertonic dehydration. And since we're losing fluids, what pressure are we losing?
Hydrostatic
pressure.
Decreased BHP.
Decreased BHP, that's right. And if you're asked to describe the fluid movement, it goes from the ICF
to
your interstitial. It's pulled back in the capillary. Okay, so fluids in a hypertonic dehydration situation move from the interstitial and intracellular space, pull it back into the capillary.
So exactly what are the terms like describing? Are they describing your salts or your fluids, like the hyper and hypo?
These are describing the concentration of salt in the fluid.
Okay.
So when I say hypertonic, I mean that there's
a lot of salt in the fluid.
In less water, yeah.
Okay.
And the fluids that we're talking about here are what's coming into your bloodstream. Yep. All right, did you get your notes jotted down for number two?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, let's do one more. Do you see another one on the list you would like to try? Number three work for you?
Yeah.
Okay. So extensive diarrhea, loss of solutes and proteins is the problem. We're looking for how that influences fluid movement. So loss of solutes and proteins.
Hypotonic
dehydration. That's number three. Okay, so the clue there was loss of solutes and proteins told me this is hypotonic dehydration, and the pressure that we lose is B.
Osmotic.
Osmotic, yeah, BOP, good.
So is it decreasing BOP?
Yeah, that's a decrease in BOP.
An increase in BHP.
Correct. All right, and so the fluids are going to move from your capillaries plasma. To where?
IF.
IF, interstitial fluid.
Intracellular
fluid, good.
Instead of writing plasma, can we write capillaries if you prefer?
I'll take either one. You want help with one more?
Yes. Yes.
You just want to do number four?
Yes.
Okay. All right, so loss of blood proteins, that's my clue. That's what pressure?
Osmotic.
Osmotic pressure is lost, BOP is lost, and you're right, that is hypotonic dehydration.
Is it
hyper? Hypo.
Okay.
Yeah. Hypotonic, BOP is lost, and fluids move from the plasma or capillary,
mm-hmm.
IF,
to the intracellular
fluid. Good.
If you want to work these, I'll be happy to do answers for you on Thursday. There's answered questions on page 125.